On today's show, we are talking faith and politics in the polite company of our special guest, Counselor Sean Hamm. This is Penhold Talk Radio. And welcome back to the show. Thank you for joining us again this week. My name is Brian Constantine. I am here with my co-host, Michael Rowland.
Hello, hello.
And we are joined this week by our special guest, Counselor Sean Hamm.
Thanks for having me on, Brian.
No, thank you for coming out and making some time for our little show here.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
And I want to acknowledge the financial sacrifice you made coming out here. Mm. I know you had to drive all the way across town.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that is a significant financial burden that I want to recognize.
Absolutely, so especially with gas prices being $1.67.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
You're driving a gas vehicle?
I'm driving a gas vehicle.
I saw a diesel hit $1.829, so you're still saving over the diesel.
I was watching another podcast, and they brought this up. Have you ever seen the movie I Am Legend?
Yes.
So it's a post-apocalyptic Will Smith movie from 2007. And there's a scene in there where he's pumping gas from an abandoned gas station in the middle of New York. And in the shot, you can see the gas price. So in this post-apocalyptic world, it was $6.80 a gallon in New York at the end of the world.
We're close to that right now.
We're over that in New York now.
We've now exceeded what they thought was apocalypse scenario.
So we have officially entered the end times. I think that's what that means. I think that's what that means.
It's starting to feel like that more every day.
Yes, that's right. Especially to the bank accounts. The end times are coming, right?
Yeah, we're gonna be walking more.
All right. So thank you for coming on and putting up with my bad jokes. But as we have done with the other ones, just kind of want to get some background, get to know you a little bit better, know your background, where you're coming from, and then we'll get into kind of the hot topics and current events and see where get your perspective on the world.
Awesome.
So let's start with, where does the story of Sean Hamm begin? What's hometown for you?
Hometown is Saskatoon, Saskatchewan.
So you're from Saskatchewan, so flatlander there.
Flatlander, absolutely. Home of 10 trees.
Saskatoon. So what eventually brought you out to Alberta? Was that moving out with your family, or was that something that you came out independently later on?
We came out with my mom and dad. Yeah. My dad had a carpet store in Saskatchewan.
Carpet store, okay.
Yeah. And a flooring store. And so he decided to move us out here. And so he had the store back there and had a store out in Red Deer as well too.
So it was an expansion, and not so much like things got bad in Saskatchewan, but things were actually quite good.
Things were quite good.
Yeah.
And he called it the Carpet Barn. And it was a unique store because in Saskatoon he painted it purple. and it has nothing to do with the barn color at all. Barn is a red color, but the purple stood out so much because if you're from Saskatoon and you drive down 22nd Street, you get to the end of 22nd Street and there's an Olympia sports store.
Okay.
And I'm a huge sports fan, so I always knew where the sports store was. My dad's store was right behind there, and it was called the Carpet Barn, and it was this purple store, and everybody knew where it was. Everybody in Saskatoon knew where the store was.
Yeah. Yeah. As far as highlighting your location, purple would seem to be a good color. It's not common.
Yeah.
I was thinking maybe he's going for like the berry, Saskatoon berries or something like that.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know. Once you've had Saskatoon berries, I mean, you don't go back. Saskatoon berry pies are the best.
So you move out there or move out with your family and your siblings. How many? What's home
I have
life?
A sister.
A sister.
Yeah. And she's in Red Deer now too.
Yeah.
And so my parents are here. We're in Penhold. Proud to be in Penhold.
Yeah. So, so when did that occur then? So
when did I move to Penhold?
So when did you actually make it out to Alberta? What time frame were we looking at?
It was 1993.
93. Okay.
And I was 16 years old.
Yeah.
Had the pop bottle glasses and the mullet back in high school, back in those days.
You didn't put any of those pictures up on social media.
No, those haven't made it up unless my wife puts them up, but I keep pretty close track of my social media. So I don't think any of that's coming up. It was through grade 11 actually, that my parents moved us up here. And, my dad sat us down as a family and said, this is what we're looking at doing. And we want to start a business, and And would you guys be in favor of that? And so it was a family decision that we made.
Yeah, I think that's got to be a big decision, especially grade 11. You know, you probably, especially assuming you grew up in Saskatoon. Yep.
All my friends and family.
Yeah, you got 11 plus years of at least grade school growing up.
Absolutely.
With those, so, yeah.
All my friends and family, and from kindergarten all the way up. But the one thing that I really liked about coming to Alberta was we were in the middle of two NHL cities. I'm a huge NHL fan, and I'm not a Calgary Edmonton fan. Mm-hmm. I'm an LA Kings fan. I've been an LA Kings fan for years. And so I was excited to come up here and because I could see Gretzky play. Gretzky was still playing back then. So I'm really dating myself now.
Yeah, yeah. And 93, was it 93? Yeah, it was 93. That was the LA Kings and Montreal Canadiens Cup Finals.
Thanks for reminding me about that. I know. Kings lost in five games. It was tough. Oh,
you are not going to get any sympathy from this Leaf fan. So,
especially Game 7?
Well, which one?
Game 6?
Which Game 7 of in Leafs history.
Yeah.
But yeah, you as a Leafs or as a Kings fan, this it's not been a bad decade of hockey down there.
No.
As far as championships go.
No, I love my hockey, and I've been a Kings fan for so many years. So in 2012, when they went to the Stanley Cup, I told my wife, I said, if they go to the Stanley Cup, I'm going to a game.
So what round did you make that promise in?
That was actually in the third round. Once they went and played the Coyotes in the conference final, I said, if they win this, I'm going to the Stanley Cup. Well, they scored the winning goal in overtime.
Oh, wow.
I went to the Stanley Cup. And so I made good on my promise. I went to LA and went for the Stanley Cup.
That's pretty cool.
It was an amazing experience.
Those are just the atmosphere that comes through just on TV alone. Being there in person would be a remarkable experience.
Absolutely. Yeah. I got my tickets from a plastic surgeon, actually a neurosurgeon. And, you know, really renowned in California, I guess. And, so he ended up sitting right beside me and we had a great time. I mean, you just gained 18,000 friends.
Oh yeah.
It was so much fun. So,
well, I think we'll eventually get to, I get the sense you have a lot of connections. But we'll perhaps get to that in a second. So you moved to Red Deer in Alberta around 93.
Yeah.
And now when did Penhold come into the equation then?
My wife and I got married in 2001. Mm-hmm. I actually met her on a mission trip to Mexico. I went to Mexico City.
Okay.
Met her on a mission trip and she moved all the way to Penhold from a city of about 26 million people. So
that's a big change.
So, yeah, big change for her.
So you met on a mission trip. Was she already in Mexico? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, she was living in Mexico City.
So is she Mexican then by birth?
No, she's Caucasian.
Okay.
She's from Toronto originally. So Leafs fan.
Yeah, okay.
Just like yourself. Yeah, and I met her down there. And then a year later, we moved out here and got married.
Okay. So you met on the mission trip. So was there two different groups that went down?
There was a group of about 45 of us.
Yeah.
It was a really big group. And my mother-in-law had said, this is a really big group. We should probably cut it in half. And they didn't want to cut it in half because they didn't want to miss somebody that should actually be on the trip.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I got billeted out to her house and I took an interest in her immediately. And they say the rest is all history. A year later, we got married and, 21 years later this summer, we're celebrating our 21st anniversary.
Congratulations.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, I met my wife. She came up to Red Deer on a mission trip.
Yeah.
And we met here. So she's originally, she's a missionary kid. So she has a lot of cities
home
in her
is
background.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
She's American. She came up here on a mission trip. And that's, I didn't go on the mission trip. She came up here. So maybe I was the one who needed help. but no, interesting connection. And so 2001, you get married. And then is that when you got married and decided to find a home together?
Yeah. And we asked the questions that most people ask is where's the best place for us to live? Mm-hmm. And more importantly, where's the cheapest place for us to live? Yeah.
Where can we afford to live?
Where can we afford to live?
Newlyweds, that's a big question.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we ended up buying our first place here in Penhold 21 years ago on Newton Drive, a half duplex. Just north of Jesse Duncan.
Okay. Yep.
And we bought it for $77,000.
Oh, that hurts to hear.
It was such a good deal. And, we bought our place and we didn't know how long we were going to stay, to be honest with you. It was the right price, the right time for Sarah and I.
Yep.
And, at the time we didn't have kids And so we stayed there for about 9 years. And then we built another house about 11 years ago on the south end of Penhold.
Okay, yeah.
And we've been here ever since. So Penhold's been home for 21 years.
Yeah, that's a significant chunk of time. Yeah.
You've seen a lot of change. Oh, we've come a long way.
We've seen a lot of change. If you if you look at even just coming through town, where the new grocery store is and the whole new subdivision where Dairy Queen's going, everything was, that was an empty field.
Oh yeah.
There was nothing on that side of the highway.
I'm like, I moved here in 2008 and it was like that. Like it just in these last 15 odd years, 12, 13 years. Yeah, it's almost doubled, I think, in size.
Yeah,
and it's not even certainly feel more modern.
Like we moved here in 2014, and that was the year the grocery store moved to their new location.
Yeah,
like when we first moved here, it was still the old grocery store. So things changed fast, and you were here long before those changes. So
yeah, we used to walk to the old grocery store.
Yeah,
all the time, and. You know, I love the setup of it, and the staff have always been friendly. That's one of the things I love about Penhold is the staff have always been friendly. And now some of those staff have actually moved over to the new store after all those years. Some staff has held on. And so that's one of the things I love about our small community.
Yeah.
Still such a small family community. Absolutely. Like you still get that sense of a small town, even with all that growth.
Yeah.
It still feels like that comfortable small town.
Absolutely.
All right. So 2001, you arrive in Penhold, and over those 20 years, now you have two sons by my research.
Yep.
Caleb and Seth, it sounds like.
Yep.
Now you've been, you're a two-term counselor.
Mm-hmm.
What finally prompted you to take on, public office, I should say.
Yeah.
Like it's not the most inviting occupation to have. It's still a small town, so it's not like you're not under the pressure of the big lights or anything like that. But it's still politics.
Yeah.
What attracts you to that? What attracted you to that in 2017, and then to come back in 2021?
That's a great question, Brian. I've always felt the call to politics, even from the first time we moved here.
Yeah.
Just watching things. Being a part of the community and always thinking I could do something, I have something to give, I have something to offer. But often in life is all timing. And, you know, my kids were little when I started feeling about going to politics and, you know, it just wasn't the right time for our family. But as the boys started to go older, we had the same questions that I had with my dad had with us when we moved out here. And I said to the boys, hey, I'm thinking about running for town council. They didn't really know what that was at the time too much.
Yeah.
Or what that looked like. But running, I had no idea what I was getting into.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, like no idea. What you think it is and what it actually is are two completely different things.
Mm-hmm.
Even in a small community, it's a steep learning curve. The first year was quite a steep learning curve for me.
Oh yeah. If you just watch one or two council meetings, there's just so much. It seems like a lot of administrative kind of things that council does and has to be aware of and get approval for and know about.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a lot going on there beyond just kind of the big kind of notable topics that usually get the attention.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's a way to give back really too. I've always been a community minded person and it's a way to give back to the community. It's a way to bring the skills and abilities that I have to the community and make it a better place.
Mm-hmm.
I often think that if everybody took the personal responsibility that they had to make the community better, you know, we'd have different communities in Alberta.
Oh yeah.
It's our responsibility. It's not everybody's responsibility to go to public office, mm-hmm. but I look at it as an honor to be an elected official. Everybody that voted for me put my name on that, you know, push my name on that, on that. I was going to say, crossed it off, but in Penhold, it's an electronic vote. You know, they pick your name mm-hmm. and they believe in you enough and what you believe in that they want to see you elected mm-hmm. and they want to represent them. And that's, I've never forgotten that, Brian. Every time I walk into the council chambers, I remember all the people that voted for me. And I think, man, I have a huge responsibility to uphold what I ran on.
Yeah. So in addition to being a counselor, you've spent the last number of years being a pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing, again, my research, and I came across a couple photos that I'll show you. And people who are watching this on video, I'll put the screenshots up there. Where are these pictures? Do you remember where these are from?
Oh, you're gonna make me tear up. I'm a very emotional guy. Those pictures are from Homahope, India. Everything's changed over the last few years. The orphanages have faced quite a bit of persecution from the government out there.
In India.
Yeah. And at the time that I visited the orphanage, there were 60 boys there, and boys that had lost their parents in the worst circumstances that you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
It's in this small little community called Kuli Pantandalam. I couldn't spell that if I wanted to. It's probably, I think it's like 26 or 30 letters long.
Wow.
But it's this oasis in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. And the poorest people there. And so we have a sponsor boy that we sponsored with the ministry. And so a lot of people don't get the opportunity to see their sponsor child in person and see where their money actually goes.
Yeah.
And he saw me and I saw him and he knew immediately who I was. He couldn't understand English. And a lot of these kids, they grew up with nothing. What our kids grew up with and, you know, the blessing that our kids have in North America.
Yeah.
Some of these kids had never been to the beach, never had an ice cream, never had a Coca-Cola. So I was able to take him to the beach, buy him an ice cream.
Yeah.
And then I took him on a shopping spree, and who doesn't like a shopping spree? Bought him a bunch of clothes and lots of ministry there too.
Yeah.
Just spending time with the boys, being a father figure to the boys. And, most of those boys don't have fathers. And, so it was a life changing experience. I've been there twice, been to India twice, love the people, love the food. Mm-hmm. Anytime I see somebody from India in any of the communities, even in Penhold, actually, there was two Indian families that I met when I was door knocking during the election.
Nice.
And it encouraged me so much to know that we have such a diverse community, even in Penhold.
Yeah.
And we talked a little bit about India, and I had said that I'd been there, and they were so excited to know that somebody knew exactly where that was. And so it was a life-changing experience in many levels.
Yeah. So that was, like you said, so those photos are probably, I think, about from 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And then as a pastor over these last 2 years, it looks like you've spent quite a bit of time ministering to people.
Yeah.
Particularly in hospital and struggling through the health ramifications of COVID.
Yeah.
I find that remarkable. I feel I'm a very cold person. So someone who can, and so I don't really connect with people emotionally.
Mm.
And I think that's something as a pastor that's so critical.
It's essential.
Yeah. And so how do you balance that kind of emotional vulnerability that you have to have as a pastor to minister to them?
It's been interesting to say the least.
Yeah.
In September, I had an opportunity to go to the hospital and pray for somebody. And it was actually on the COVID ward.
Mm.
And my faith is a very important part of my life, and Jesus prayed for the lepers, and so I'm not scared of a sickness or a virus, and I went in and prayed for these people because a lot of people wouldn't go in and pray for them.
Yeah,
and so I ended up praying for well over 35 people over the last few months, which I knew about 8 of them. It got around that I was going in and praying for people, and so. It was an amazing opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, you're meeting people for the first time, and a lot of people are very unsure of what's going to happen with their life, with their particular sickness. Most of them were COVID issues. But just being there with people, and like you said, having that spirit of empathy and being able to just listen to people. And that's the biggest thing. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times in our society, we always want to try and fill in the blanks for people. And we always want to give our answers, but a lot of times people just to be heard.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially over these last 2 years, it's there's more and more stats come out about the ramification or the, and the health ramifications of that social isolation that has been prompted. And so, yeah, just being able to interact with someone, especially someone who's on a hospital, they're probably in isolation or with very few visitors. It's not like in these last 2 years, like you had to have a specific reason to get in the hospital. And so just being able to meet people, interact with people, and then have someone pray with you during those times. That's got to be a meaningful event normally, and just all the more when such isolation is being put in place.
Absolutely. And we saw so many miracles in the hospital too, which was absolutely amazing. And people that had gone through that were given sentences that they shouldn't have lived ended up living. And it was just amazing to see that. And so I look at it as a blessing to be there. I know a lot of people were scared to go to the hospital during this time, but it didn't scare me. I know that people needed somebody there for them, and I was happy to play my part during this season.
All right, so that I think sets up kind of the second half of our conversation nicely with your position. You have your foot in two kind of dangerous camps, or at least camps that you don't talk about in play society.
Don't talk about faith and don't talk about politics. That's like the rules of our society. If you don't want to cause conflict, those are the two things you avoid.
I'll push back on that a little bit. That used to be the only two things. It seems like anything now, right?
Now it's kind of a free for all, but everything causes conflict. Now. So.
Yeah,
absolutely. You hit the nail right on the head, Brian.
So let's talk about these things in play society. Let's break that myth right here and now. How do you manage being a Christian in public office? As an outsider, I don't have the burden of being a representative. So I feel like I'm more free to try to sway council or talk to my official or my representatives or get my voice out here like in a podcast. I don't have to worry about people, that's fine. He can have that opinion, but good thing he doesn't have a vote or he doesn't represent me kind of idea.
Right.
How do you balance kind of your Christian beliefs and your role as a public servant?
Well, I've been very open with it. With people. If anybody follows me on social media, they can see that. Even just door knocking. I decided to door knock during this campaign because I felt it was really important for people to see a face and to see who I am, and just sharing who I am at the door, and that I am a Christian and that I have a strong faith in God, and that plays a part in my life. People really appreciate honesty.
Yeah.
Especially in politics.
It's a rare trait in a politician.
We've talked about it. I prefer a politician that I disagree with, but I know where I disagree. Like I want a principled politician.
Right.
Like we can disagree, but at least I know where he's going. He's principled. And then we can have a conversation. It's the ones that kind of jump back and forth, who kind of just follow the latest trends or kind of the most political savvy move, and you feel like they're playing an actor. So yeah, honesty. I don't care what side of the aisle you are on politically, but just be an honest politician, which absolutely just seems an oxymoron. But yeah, if you can, yeah, that goes a long ways, regardless of where you stand politically.
Yeah, and I hear the stories from people like you guys do. All politicians are bad. the generalization of that. And I always wanted to be different than that. I wanted to be somebody that, what I decided to, I was very clear with what I believe in, and, I got the second highest amount of votes in the election. So obviously
it resonated with people.
Absolutely.
In some way or another, it resonated with them.
Yeah. And having that strong view, at the door, people really appreciated that. And they appreciate when they ask me the hard questions that I was honest with them. I didn't give them a political answer that they're used to getting. And so my faith is at the foundation of everything I do.
Yep.
And, I've heard people say, well, you can't bring your faith into politics. You got to be able to separate those
yeah,
two.
Yeah, right.
But the way that I look at my faith is it has to be a part of my everyday life and everything I do. It's where I go. It's where I work. It's who I talk to. It's the decisions that I make. My faith is the foundation of everything I do.
Yep.
And again, people elected me to serve the community, knowing what my faith stance is. That should be an integral part of the decisions that I'm making on council.
Yeah.
And I believe I've made decisions on council that have been based by my on my faith.
Yeah. And
very difficult decisions.
Yeah. And I don't think that should be a surprise, because I think everyone does that. It seems this kind of topic of faith and politics usually ends up kind of being a conversation about that only seems to affect religious politicians.
Right.
As if religious politicians and their beliefs have to be isolated from their public view. But everyone has the core foundational beliefs in life. Mm-hmm. They all have things that they are judging whether or not, or their vote on. They have some sort of moral foundation that they're saying, I'm going to vote this way based on some sort of moral code.
Right.
And you can't tell me that, that is a personal, that they're somehow taking their personal beliefs out of it. Because here's the thing, if you want to say, this is the position that I hear politicians say all the time, is that I'm not going to, or I'm going to take my personal beliefs out of my political life.
Yeah.
But that statement in itself is a personal belief.
Sure. Absolutely.
So you can't get away from it. You have a personal belief that I'm not going to bring my personal beliefs into my political decision making.
And they're difficult decisions that you have to make.
Yes.
And, you know, I'll bring up the decision we had to make last term, mm-hmm. The cannabis decision that council had to make. Very, very difficult decision for council to make. But again, you know, my personal beliefs, I don't take cannabis. You know, I don't believe in it.
Yeah.
You know, I believe it's a drug and can lead to other things. And that's a personal conviction that I have. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when it came down to that at the community level, my vote reflected that.
Yeah.
Because that was important to me.
Yeah.
And I don't want to see kids getting involved in drugs at a young age and getting into issues with their lives. And so, that was very important to me to vote that way. And speak what's true, not what's true to me, because everybody says, well, what's my truth?
Yeah, yeah, that's the catch.
And I think that's a real issue. But the truth that I believe on is the Bible. That's my basic foundation.
Yeah.
And so if it doesn't align with the Bible, then I can't vote in favor of something that doesn't align with the Bible.
Yeah, and just to reiterate, you place your kind of your moral foundation on Scripture. But everyone has their own foundation for their morality,
right?
Wherever that may be. And so I really want people to understand is that this topic of faith and politics is not just about religious people.
Right.
Everyone has those core beliefs that they're judging everything on.
And your experiences shape who you are.
Yeah.
I really believe that. Yeah. Like what people go through and how they're raised, that shapes their experiences. But you got to be able to have those difficult conversations, and that's not happening. If you look in our provincial government, our federal government, you can't have difficult conversations without a screaming match and things like that. And you know, one thing about our council team, we've been able to have difficult conversations and still respect each other, and still see the town move forward. And I think that's very, very important.
Mm-hmm. So I try to watch the council meetings, in order to first of all report back through the podcast, since there isn't any kind of local reporter on it. So hopefully I can do a little bit of that service. I want to know what decisions the council is making, but I'm perhaps more interested in trying to be able to discern why a councillor is making that decision. What's kind of their fundamental ideology or foundational beliefs that are kind of pushing them in this direction.
Yeah,
I'm curious about this most recent one, and a vote that or a statement that you made. So with the and I'm going to put you on the spot, but I don't want to put you on the spot. But anyways, there was a vote during the chicken bylaw again, and council changed the neighborhood neighborhood acknowledgement form. So before you had to go get permission from your neighbors, and that was changed to just simply getting their acknowledgement.
Right.
You just kind of letting them know.
Yeah.
So let them know that you're planning to have chickens. And so at least the neighbors no longer have veto power. Right. As over what you're going to do. It's just, you just got to inform them though.
Yes.
And part of the conversation though was whether or not that was necessary at all, mm-hmm. that kind of information, since it's not really, doesn't seem to have much weight in the whole application process.
Right.
And you made a comment in kind of whether or not to keep the whole neighborhood or the neighbor notification in there at all, was that you thought it was a kind of a good neighborly thing to do. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the thought process there. Why do you think that council should have kept that in? Like, I agree that it was kind of good. It's a good neighbor. Like, yeah, if you're putting check-ins in, let your neighbors know. That's just, I think that's just being a good neighbor, to repeat myself.
Yeah.
But why keep that in the bylaw? Why kind of put that in as it were, the law of Penhold?
Yeah.
And what was your thinking going through that?
I feel it's important that people communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you want to put something in your yard, you can put something in your yard. If you want to build a shed, if you want to, you know, do some upgrades, you can do that.
Yeah.
You know, if you're putting chickens in your yard, you know, I think it's good to have an acknowledgement to the neighbors. I think it shows that you're willing to have those conversations with your neighbors. Mm-hmm. And I said at the meeting, I believe too, it's good for people to talk to each other.
Yep.
I think in a society where the last 2 years we've been isolated for the most part from people, for people to be able to talk to each other and go to the door and say, hey, I may have not seen you in the last couple of years, but
the chickens are coming.
The chickens are coming. But I said it actually at a meeting. It's probably about three meetings before that, or two meetings before that. One of my main reasons for voting for it, I was actually against it at the beginning.
Okay, this was just, I'm just talking about the neighborhood notice.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, yeah.
No, but I just want people to make sure, because you actually voted for the bill itself, or for the bylaw itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so.
And one of the reasons why I voted for it, and I mentioned the comments in a couple council meetings earlier, there's so much government control right now.
Yes.
And the government is overstepping in so many areas. Yeah. And for me, it wasn't necessarily about chickens. It was about, if people want to put chickens in your yard, let's give it to people to make their own choices. Mm-hmm. There's government that's over legislating everything.
Yeah.
And this gives people an opportunity. Food prices are going through the roof. If people want to have chickens and have their own eggs and things like that, that help with their food supply, or if they want to use it as an educational purpose for their children. I just think it's great to give something back to the people, where people can actually start to make their own decisions again. And that was a big part of the vote that I felt wasn't very important.
So yeah, you mentioned the government overreach, and being a pastor, no doubt you felt that those restrictions quite personally over these last two years.
Absolutely.
Churches, businesses, in particular, have been hit hard by a number of these restrictions. And since we're kind of on this whole faith and politics, we'll kind of keep it to kind of the church realm. But in Alberta, there have been three pastors that have been arrested over these last 2 years over refusal to abide by these health restrictions. We had Arthur Pulowski, we had James Coe up in Edmonton with Grace Baptist, and then down in Calgary at Tim Stevens, I believe. What is your approach, or what kind of reaction have you had over these last 2 years regarding this kind of tension between government and church? And I mentioned those three names, but those are just Alberta. I know there's been churches over in Manitoba, particularly in Ontario, that have also kind of been vocal in opposing it. Quite frankly, for me, it's been too few voices pushing back against some of these. But what has been your kind of reaction or experience over these last couple of years?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there still is a pastor that's in jail right now. Arthur Pulowski is still in jail in Calgary. And, you know, to see government overreach like that over the last 2 years, to see him arrested on the freeway in broad daylight.
Yeah, that was the first time, I think. First time that was his first arrest. Yeah,
and made quite an example of it. And, you know, that's the issue that I've had during this last time, is there's been the government overreach has really pushed it too far when it comes to churches. Mm-hmm. If you're in a place where people are struggling emotionally and mentally, the most important place for them to be is the church. They need to be in community. They need to be around other people. They need prayer if they're sick.
Yep.
The church should never shut down, ever. Hebrews 10:25 talks about that. Then don't give up meeting together, mm-hmm. as some are in the habit of doing. And so these pastors could easily be looked upon as being, you know, rebellious or anything like that. But again, it goes back to foundation, and yep. they're following what God has given them scripturally. And Arthur hasn't broken any laws, met their mandates.
Yep.
And the mandates that have been put in are very subjective. And I've been very vocal about that from the beginning, that the mandates that have been put in haven't done anything to curb any sort of spread or curb the sickness and things like that. I've seen COVID patients. So I know the depths. I've probably seen more COVID patients than a lot of people except doctors.
Yep.
And so I've seen what that has done.
Yep.
But there's also the restrictions that were put in place that had nothing to do with that. You know, really hurt people in our province. And there's a mental aspect of that that we haven't even seen to this day, how that's going to affect people.
You mentioned that. I came across this article. I'm not sure if it was one that you shared or it might have been something connected. But anyways, Stats Canada has estimated, and this is from a National Post article, I'll put the sources up on pendletalkradio.ca, but in this article it says that Stats Canada estimates that there were 19,884 excess deaths, and so these were more deaths than would normally be expected in Canada, and those are deaths between March 2020 and May 2021. And so while it says, excess deaths early in the pandemic largely occurred among seniors and were attributable to COVID-19, such deaths rose significantly later on among younger Canadians and were not caused by the virus. And so here's some interesting stats that they've compiled. Approximately 35% so 35% of that 19,000 number, so over 7,200 people, of total excess deaths occurred among those between 45 and 64, despite demographic accounting for only 7% of COVID-related deaths. So 35 versus 7. Mm-hmm. Perhaps, and the article continues, perhaps even more disturbing, approximately 15.6% or about 3,100 of Canada's excess deaths occurred among those younger than 44, even though that youngest cohort accounts for only 0.7% of the country's COVID-19 deaths. So we look at kind of what is the normal amount of death over a certain time frame, and we look back on this portion between March 2020 and May 2021, and we see almost 20,000 more deaths than kind of what we'd statistically expect to see. Mm-hmm. And instantly people think, well, of course, we got a pandemic, right? It makes sense. But here we're looking at almost half of that number being in demographics that were not significantly affected by COVID. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, okay, why? And the report goes on and talks about the increase in suicide rates, mm-hmm. or suicide attempts even. Yeah. It goes on to talk about the drug or the opioid epidemic.
Absolutely.
That's going on. When you talk about the suicide, like there's just so many things that feed into someone's decision to go that route.
Yeah.
And that's where the kind of the mental stability of people, mm-hmm. the mental health of people. And it's hard. It's hard to just say that we have to lock down in order to save, or to protect the hospitals or something like that. It's easy to see that, yes, okay, I agree with that because we can count.
Right.
We can count how many people are in hospitals, how many people are dying, that kind of thing. These stats are the stats that are going to come out later on.
Yeah.
And I'm concerned about the ramifications that this is going to have, far longer ramifications, I think, trying to get those people back on their feet. And these are issues that are a lot harder to quantify. Mm-hmm. And that I think is where a lot of the churches hopefully would be pushing back, because they recognize their role in helping these kind of situations, or at least I would hope that these last few years has awakened the church to realize how necessary it is in society and the overall health of society, which sadly I think most churches have kind of just given up on.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. And I think the most important thing that people need is community. We were designed to be with other people. Mm-hmm. And the minute you separate people and isolate people, even just talking to people in the hospital, that was the hardest thing that yeah. people dealt with, was being isolated in a room where you only get to see somebody's eyes because your face is covered with all the PPE and everything. And, yep. you know, it's awful. There's no visitors allowed and things like that. And so, you know, I did probably 6 or 7 funerals during this last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're having to pick and choose out of 20 people who's going to come to a funeral.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's awful decisions that people had to make, or young people are getting married and couldn't get married yep. with a full room of people. They had to pick 20 people that they could have at their wedding. And so, you know, that's very difficult on people. And, you've seen the effects of it, and COVID did affect people's lives and people did die from it.
Yeah.
But the proportion of the lockdowns and the mental health that has happened, I really believe that there needs to be a complete investigation in how the government has run this last 2 years, provincially and federally.
Yeah.
And I do believe we need AHS reform as well too. And I've been in ICU before COVID. It was the same size that it is now.
Yep.
Same amount of beds, same amount of everything. Nothing's changed. We got to change that. That has to change moving forward. COVID or not, it needs to change.
Well, I think COVID has definitely revealed the flaws in our system more than caused the flaws in the system.
Yeah.
It's shone a light on how we've become very lazy in our healthcare system.
Yeah, I agree.
They've just become complacent and kept the status quo for too many years, and it's, well, population grows and everything else expands, and now COVID hit and we saw that's not going to cut it.
Yeah. Yeah. Many problems were revealed during this last time. Yeah. And so we just need to learn from them mm-hmm. as a society. We need to learn from them. How do we do better? There's been municipal overreach too.
Yeah.
We've seen it in places like Edmonton, where the mask bylaw was.
finally, up until recently,
pulled off. And you don't have any medical background. As municipal leaders, you don't have a medical background.
Yeah.
So there's just been overreach in every area. And we know what we're elected on. We need to do the job that we were elected to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I don't think this is just a church issue when we're talking about government overreach over these last 2 years.
Part
of that is because I think everyone's been affected by some sort of infringement. Maybe it's your business, your kids had to be kept home from school. A number of court decisions, while they've sided with the health officials every time, they've always recognized that this was an infringement.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that I've had, especially over these last 2 years, is the fact that there has been there's been a lack of evidence provided that backs up the justification of that infringement.
Absolutely.
I think it was just this last week or the week before, the Quebec government, they instituted their curfew, at the end of last year, right around New Year's Eve. And it's just come out this last week or two that it was the day that they made the announcement about their curfew that they went looking for evidence to justify that before they went to press conference.
So they're making their moves politically and then looking for mm-hmm. medical or health reasons for it.
Yeah.
At least that's what I would get from that. Like, the decision's made on a political basis because they didn't have the evidence before making the decision.
Yeah. And so to me, it ends up, it seems that there's a kind of a hierarchy of rights, and all those rights seem to come subservient to under the government. I won't go much further because I'll probably end up talking about what I'm not really confident on, but it seems that if the government and the courts were so quick to side with the government, it seems like they gave priority to the government mm-hmm. over the rights.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I would think it would have to be the other way around, even almost to the point of irresponsible is probably a little bit too strong a word, but I would want the government or the courts and the government to side that way, to be almost irresponsibly giving personal rights or mm-hmm. letting people keep it.
Mm-hmm.
And allowing them to
exercise, because I think those are personal rights are pre-political, that they are rights that we have as human beings created in the image of God.
Yep.
And the government is there to protect them. And if the government wants to take them away, it becomes incumbent upon them, and according to our Constitution, that they have to show that is reasonably, or done, or it has to be reasonably justified. And yet there's just been so lack in providing that kind of information.
Yeah, it's been just an overreach on all areas. And we can't have that in our society. Like I said early on at the beginning, I was elected by the people. I haven't forgotten that. We have to, elected officials have to remember that's, you're elected by the people, you serve the people don't serve you. That's not, that's a wrong form of government. When government ends up being that way, where people serve the government, you get into authoritarian government and totalitarian government. And,
yep.
You know, we've had people that have laid down their lives for our country, and the freedom of our country is something that's very, very important to me.
And so let's segue that into kind of the final idea here, is kind of that kind of authoritarian tendency that we've kind of experienced over these last 2 years, or at least this kind of permissive authoritarianism. And I say permissive because it's tragic how easily Canadians have given up and are freely kind of abided by these restrictions. And it's not that I don't think there is actually probably some reason to follow along or do these restrictions. It was the fact that the government forced you to do it mm-hmm. and didn't allow people to take kind of the personal responsibility. And I think that's where you start to see authoritarian creep come in, especially when the government says, oh, I can tell you not to do this and you'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how it is at the lower levels, but we've talked about the people who strive for those top positions. Power is a key appeal to it.
Absolutely. And government usually doesn't give power back very easily.
Once you've let that leash go, you can't get it back.
You're absolutely right, Michael. And it's a very difficult and scary place to be.
Yeah.
You know, with this COVID issue that we had, you know, there was no talk about preventative measures. And that was one of the things that concerned me too. You know, vitamin C and vitamin D mm. and zinc and quercetin is another one. There's actually preventative medications, like healthy, natural
proper care.
Supplements that if people cared for themselves and drank water and actually all the simple things that we've been told as little kids from school what to do to be healthy. There's been a lack of that from our government.
From the government, but then anyone, any state sanctioned or social media sanctioned expert speaking about those kind of topics was pulled off or was silenced
absolutely.
In some way.
Yep.
And that's kind of an authoritarianism, kind of a private, if you will, private authoritarianism from private companies, which have the power now of governments. And like, I don't think you look back even 50 years or even 20 years ago and see the kind of the power that the companies have now on such a massive scale.
Mm-hmm. That should be concerning to everybody.
Oh, I think so. I think so. It's kind of interesting just to kind of bring Ukraine into the conversation, and you look at all the different sanctions that are going on, and even if you agree with kind of what those sanctions are, it should concern you that Visa or MasterCard can flip a switch and your credit card is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. No, like, kidding. They've shut down everybody's ability in Russia to do anything.
Yeah. So like I said, whether or not you agree with it, the fact that power exists should be concerning.
And it's a scary slope. Yeah. And you see, you know, athletes that aren't allowed to compete in sports now because they're from Russia.
Yeah, it's unreal.
You see stores in in Alberta that are being vandalized because they're Russian owned.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit last week.
Yeah,
it just seemed like there's just this so much anti-Russian that it just seemed like that had to be the outcome.
Seeing how fast that happened.
Yeah,
really fast. Like it was. Well, and it's pushed by governments and by these corporations and by just Absolutely. The general culture on social media. And within a matter of days, we went from not thinking much about Russia to thinking very negatively about Russia.
Yeah.
And then, like we said, the corporations that can flick a switch and Russia no longer can function.
I think we have to be very concerned, especially in our culture, where people have been taken off of Twitter, Facebook, just for having views that are against what the narrative is from the media. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very scary spot to be. You know, my parents told me as a kid growing up, you can disagree with people and still be friends, right?
what a novel idea.
What a novel idea. And why can't we have these difficult conversations?
Yeah.
And why can't people put views that are different than maybe what majority of people believe? Mm-hmm. As long as they're not abusive and they're not, you know, they're not hateful in nature.
Yeah.
Why can't we have people sharing their views? That's what freedom of speech is. And freedom of speech is under attack in North America, especially in Canada over this last period of time.
Yeah. There's a kind of an interesting, thought out there. That or reaction, I guess, especially to what's happened recently in our country with Trudeau instituting the Emergencies Act and then getting criticized by that and people like even people on the left reacting, like even Europe is like, oh man, you guys, that was a little strange over there, wasn't it, Mr. Trudeau? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, when Europe is starting to criticize you, but there's, I don't know, it feels like people in democracies seem to think that it can't be authoritarian in nature, or at least it's, you know, I would recognize authoritarianism when I saw it. And so, you know, when Trudeau institutes his Emergencies Act, that's not really authoritarianism. We live in a democracy. I still got to cast my vote.
Yeah.
And it seems like if as long as we have a democracy, we aren't really in danger of kind of authoritarian overreach or authoritarian mm-hmm. government. Now I want to kind of mention that because Trudeau was mentioned or was over in over or making a speech over in Ontario, and he mentioned this kind of tendency over the last few years. He says, we've come to a moment that, quite frankly, we've seen coming over these last past years. And so this is from an article from the Post-Millennial. We've talked about it in the news, not just about Ukraine, but about democracies around the world that we have seen We've talked about it in the news, not just about Ukraine, but about democracies around the world that we see a bit of slippage in our democracies. And then he continues kind of giving an example. So countries, this is his quote, countries turning towards slightly more authoritarian leaders, countries allowing increasing misinformation and disinformation to be shared on social media, turning people against values and the principles of democracies that are so strong. So follow along with what he's saying there. So there's this quote, slippage in democracies. And then he gives two examples. Countries that are moving towards more authoritarian leaders, mm-hmm. and then countries allowing increasing misinformation and disinformation.
Right.
That second one seems like a place not authoritarian, because a place that's authoritarian wouldn't allow anything to be said. Here, apparently, it's authoritarian to allow misinformation and disinformation to get out there. That's what he just said.
And it's interesting because, you know, Facebook right now, it there's keywords to it that if you post on Facebook, it'll actually say something underneath that says whether this is accurate information or not. And I guess my question is who's the one that decides whether the information's accurate?
Yeah. That's what I mean. That's where you have your social media and state sanctioned experts. Yeah.
Just to throw a fun fact in there, during an interview with Congress, Facebook admitted that their fact checkers are opinion based. So,
yeah. You'll have to send me the link so I can post that one. Yeah. But yeah, I remember that.
But we, you know, going back to like information, you know, there were doctors early on that spoke out about COVID, and those doctors were silenced early on.
Yeah.
You know, why couldn't we, in the democracy that we're in, why couldn't we have a debate talking about those differences, and allowing people to make their own decisions on it instead of just one side of, you know, what was being said to us.
Yeah. And that's kind of the thought that led me to that quote is in authoritarian governments, you actually try to shut down all the quote misinformation or disinformation, because that's what authoritarians do.
Yeah.
But in democracies, we actually confront misinformation with other facts or with truth. We have that dialogue. And it was just in another article where Trudeau was making the point that, let's see if I can find the actual quote here. Yeah, so it was today. He's over, at least today, as part of this recording. He's over in Europe, making a little bit of a tour. But here's a quote from Trudeau. He says, quote, "Diversity of ideas helps us learn from one another. Mm-hmm. Talking to people who think differently from us is how we challenge ourselves, and challenging ourselves is how we grow." Now think about the dissonance of that statement and what just happened just 2 weeks ago. And this goes back to the honesty of politicians.
Absolutely.
Like, just tell me what your principles are, Mr. Trudeau, and then I can engage with that. This kind of double talk, you are at best dishonest. Mm-hmm. And at worst, just kind of malevolent towards democracy. You're just kind of waving your hand at it and saying the right words, while your actions seem to show a disdain for that.
Well, and I mean, he called the truckers that were going out there, you know, he called them a small fringe minority
with unacceptable views.
Exactly.
Along with a few other choice words that were less than appropriate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then they're Nazi sympathizers, essentially.
And misogynists and racists. Yeah. And he used a whole slew of words that are the kind of the talking point words to get attention now.
They are, and they're used very loosely.
Yes.
When a disagreement is against the narrative of what's out there.
Yeah.
And you know, the truckers, I thought it was great. I thought it was, mm-hmm. you know, there's people that are willing to take time off work. Some people have lost everything for them to go up there. I know people that live in Ottawa, and I know people that were on the ground there, and you know, they cleaned up after themselves. Yep. They were cleaning Tim Hortons, sweeping the floors. you know, these were people that just wanted to be heard. And I thought this whole thing of this emergency act could have been avoided if Trudeau would have just sent his, you know, if you would
he didn't have to go out there, just send someone.
Send somebody, have the conversation, and allow the dialogue to continue. Let's have a conversation. The city of Ottawa actually met with the mayor actually met with the convoy.
Yeah.
And talked about some solutions. So why couldn't the federal government do that? And I think that's the breakdown of where people start looking at Trudeau as an authoritarian leader that says, well, I'm not going to talk to the people. I'm above the people.
Yeah. But then a short time later comes out with a statement saying that we need a diversity of opinion and we need to talk to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously that diversity of opinion has a select narrow group of which I can pick.
Which opinions are acceptable to be diverse.
It's contradictory in nature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much.
All right. So let me finish on with one quote from Rex Murphy, because his article, or his weekly post, are just terrific. And then hopefully we can end on a little bit of an upbeat note. So in Rex Murphy's recent article in the National Post, he says, "The final current in this Christmas cake of overreach," he's just listed off all the different things that have happened. came when the Emergencies Act made it to Parliament for confirmation. It got half a vote. The Commons, specifically the Liberals and the ersatz Liberal NDP, mm-hmm. voted for it. It never made it to the confirmation vote in the Senate. Trudeau revoked what he had invoked before it could. Now there's a curiosity. The unprecedented deployment of near wartime powers had 9 days of exercise over the lives of Canadian citizens, reaching into their private affairs and their bank accounts, and it never received the confirmation of the full Parliament. And what do you think? Was that a bit of slippage? A bit of slippage in one of the democracies, namely ours? So think about that. There's 9 days in which the government, one person essentially, signs off on it, and all of a sudden bank accounts are frozen. RCMP says you can go here and not here. All that without parliamentary approval. So you had 9 days of basically free reign with this act. And so, yes, I think if nothing else, this is the proof text that authoritarianism can occur within democracies. Mm-hmm. And we have to be careful and call this what it is. Absolutely. Lest we give our politicians the impression that this is okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's never okay to freeze bank accounts. You know, when we look at it, 25,
that's huge.
People were that gave $25 had their bank accounts froze. Yeah. And were given to a cause that they believed in. Whether people, you know, there was question of the GoFundMe page and there's questions of where it was going and all that sort of thing.
Recently, just to jump in there, it was 88% of the donations were Canadian dollars.
I heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's no terrorist funding going on there.
No.
And that was again mentioned by Liberal politicians.
And I heard an article which really encouraged me too. The truckers talked about that they were going to actually donate $5 million of that, to help with the drinking water issue that every politician has promised our Indigenous people over the last number of years. Yeah. And so I'm thinking, man, if I was in that decision-making office and you're going to give us $5 million to help with this problem, you better be able to take that and say, let's help solve this problem. But instead it was all frozen and now nobody knows where the money's going. You know, last I heard, people weren't even getting refunded at this point yet.
Yeah, so. No, it's still frozen as of the recording.
Yeah,
the protest. This is just one of those rare protests that the more and more it went on, the worse it looked for the politicians. Like right. I've never seen a protest like this. Like it was like the largest troll party,
and it never devolved into like mob chaos. Rule. Yeah. It was one of the most civil. Like we said before, I think in a previous one, it was like a block party.
Yeah.
It was like the longest running block party you've ever seen.
Yeah. I knew people that took their kids to Parliament
Hill. Oh yeah. Bouncy houses.
You're not taking your kids to a dangerous place.
No.
Any of us would do anything we can to protect our kids.
Yeah.
But it was a safe place for people to be. And I thought it was great that people spoke up.
We needed it.
I think it's changed, you know, the landscape of Canada in a positive way. I don't know about you guys, but I've seen more Canada flags in central Alberta. And that's one of the things that Americans have always done well is they've always had so much pride in their country. And seeing more Canadian flags on cars and houses, I think it's great. I think there's some good things, positive things that are coming out of this.
So wrapping up, we've gone through and talked about the faith in politics and government overreach and authoritarianism. Do you have any hope for the future? is there any bright spots that we can look forward to? What's your outlook?
Yeah, that's a great question, Brian. Again, it's faith-based for me, of course.
Yeah, no doubt.
You know, I believe there's hope in Jesus Christ, and there's hope in not in circumstances around us. We have hope in Him. But again, if we all do our part, if everybody does their part, and if everybody, you know. It starts with kindness at the grocery store. If you treat the cashier well, or you pay it forward at a coffee, or it's the simple things, holding the door open for somebody. Those things done on a consistent basis really bring people together. And so we have an amazing opportunity right now to bring people together in community mm-hmm. and to bring people back with similar values. I really believe that, you know, generally most people love our country and most people are proud Albertans. And so let's look at the things that we are united on instead of the things that we're divided against. And let's work on that basis. Okay, we agree on these things, but let's allow people to have those conversations, because it's important to be able to still have those conversations and respect each other. And so I think our country, after the convoy, seeing people come together, seeing people on the highways with Canada flags honking their horns, we only saw that during Olympics. You never saw that during any other time.
Yeah.
And so that's a part that's come out of it that's positive.
Yeah.
You know, you see in Alberta, you see the economy starting to turn around a bit. The oil field starting to turn around. So there's some positivity with that. People are getting jobs again. There's some positivity that way. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I want to look at it and say that this last season's been tough. Absolutely. Yeah. Everybody's gone through a tough season. But there's bright spots that are coming, and I believe better things are still going to come.
I'll leave it with that. Yeah, I agree. So I won't bring my cynicism in too much. When you're talking about, you know, the kind of holding the doors open and the community spirit, like that, I see that resonating in this community.
Yeah,
and we talked about it a little bit with the mayor. I think we fared well as a community. No doubt there's struggles, but I didn't sense any kind of division or unnecessary conflict. I don't see Penhold as a community or a town divided.
No,
I think we've done well, and hopefully we can just use these last 2 years where we kind of hung in there for each other, even if we disagreed with people. We still recognize them as fellow Penholders, fellow citizens, and moved through these two last years together as a community, and hopefully we can continue to do that going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. We've come up. We're so strong right now in Penhold. Mm-hmm. Dairy Queen's going up.
Yes,
I'm super excited about
the
summer
bright spots. We didn't even mention that. The lights are on it.
Yes,
I saw that they put the signs up. The drive-through advertising things are up there. So
like, I'm so excited.
It's
about
coming.
That.
Okay. I think we found the happy point to finish off.
Dairy Queen,
come on.
We're brought us all back to that.
Yeah. All right. Yes, the lights are on at Dairy Queen. There is a brighter future coming.
Literally.
Forward. Yes, exactly. All right. Well, hopefully, you enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for joining us, Councillor Hamm.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
No, this is a great conversation. It's a conversation that needs to be had. Hopefully, even if you disagreed, this is a conversation that at least helps highlight perhaps the other side of an issue for you. Perhaps this helps to show you that there are other people that agree with your position, and you don't have to necessarily kind of keep it to yourself. Let's have these conversations out in the open. We don't have to isolate these different opinions. Let's dialogue with one another and hopefully get closer to the truth.
Absolutely.
All right. So with that, thank you for joining us. My name is Brian Constein.
And I'm Michael Rowland.
And this has been Penhold Talk Radio.